I'm Wendy Ring.
I'm Brian Curtis. Welcome to Cool Solutions, stories about climate action from the bottom up. We live in strange and upsetting times. Even though there's an existential crisis underway, if you look around, all you see is business as usual. To all outward appearances, it's as if we think climate change isn't happening.
But opinion surveys show that most of us really do know better. More than half of Americans report that they've personally experienced impacts from global warming. Nearly three quarters are worried about it. And a shocking 45% of people aged 16 to 25 report climate anxiety so severe that it's affecting their daily life and functioning.
Even elderly people don't think this is just a young person's problem. Over half of Americans age 65 and up expect climate change will harm them personally in their lifetime.
So it's not that people don't know or don't care.
I think it's more that people don't know what they can do.
With so little time left to pull off giant changes and a political system paralyzed by big money, it's hard for an individual worried person to see how they can make a difference.
Yet we need everyone, because without pressure from regular citizens, those big changes aren't going to happen.
One pool of potential activists is that big demographic bulge of baby boomers leaving the workforce. If you Google climate change and retirement, you get pages and pages about where to put your retirement home where it won't get burned, flooded, or too hot to go outside. But some people are staying put and dedicating their golden years to fighting climate change itself. In this episode, we've got stories about people Bill McKibben calls experienced Americans, finding their place in the climate movement. We'll hear more about this from Bill himself later in the show. Experienced Americans sounds a little bit to me like pre-owned cars, but I guess we retirees do have some mileage on us. Our story starts about 10 years ago, at a time when climate change seemed distant to most people. To see it, you'd have to go visit a glacier, unless you were a doctor, in which case climate change came to you. Although not everyone recognized it at first, it walked right into our hospitals and clinics.
Montana internal medicine doctor Rob Byron saw smoke from Western wildfires sending his patients to the emergency room.
I had to encourage patients not to go outside during smoke-filled parts of the summer because of their lung or heart disease. When I first started practice in the early 90s, that was a non-issue. By the early teens, it was a common issue.
And not just in the West. By 2014, nearly 80% of members of the American Thoracic Society, a professional organization for doctors specializing in respiratory and critical care medicine, reported that they were seeing the health impacts of climate change in their hospital and exam rooms.
Pediatricians, like Rob's wife, Lori, saw more premature babies born as a result of increased temperatures.
I like to say we had an epiphany. In medical terms, more appropriately, we had no crap moment. When we realized that caring for individual patients in the hospital or in the exam room really wasn't going to make a difference if we didn't do something about climate change.
In California, Cynthia Mahoney, a nephrologist, was seeing changes in her practice.
I started really noticing more and more patients, mostly people with heart failure and advanced kidney disease, decompensating during heat waves. You know, at first, it'd be like one at a time. I would adjust their diuretics and their ACE inhibitors and their blood pressure parameters.
But it became so common that she created a protocol for her patients, a set of DIY instructions.
If it's over 90 degrees, if your blood pressure is below 120, cut your blood pressure medication in half. If it's below 100, then stop it and call me. And temporarily, I felt pretty good about that.
But then she started seeing her young, healthy patients get sick. She gave me this example.
About 2014, one of my relatively healthy young patients came in for a routine visit, and he was in acute kidney failure. He's working outside as a landscaper in 105-degree heat for the last 5 days. So I said, you know, it's not enough for me to have this protocol. If I really want to prevent this, we've got to get to the root causes, which is climate change. I feel like all my training in the science and my experience in caring for patients, it's just been aiming me here.
Rob and Cynthia are now full-time climate activists. While their first motivation was preventing worst-case global warming, they've since discovered that climate solutions have immediate health benefits. clean electricity and vehicles, and walkable, bikeable communities decrease rates of diseases we're already struggling to treat, like diabetes, heart and lung disease, obesity, and cancer. And these system-level changes have the power to heal inequities and create healthy communities, something you can't do by handing out pills to people who are already sick. For most doctors, this was a revelation.
During my entire medical career, I've been talking with everyone about the dangers of tobacco smoke. And it's only in the past 10 years that it really clicked that tobacco smoke's another type of air pollution.
It's a big change from quiet and thoughtful one-on-one patient care to the political sausage machine.
There are some skills that carry over.
One of the primary ones is approaching people where they are. Lecturing to people does not help. What does help is if we feel like we're working together on something that's mutually important to all of us.
Robin Laurie helped organize a statewide group called Montana Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate, which has around 300 members.
That doesn't sound like many, but that's a significant portion of the healthcare professionals in Montana.
They've helped schools get air quality monitors and flag systems so they'll know when kids have to be kept indoors, produced a 200-page report on climate change and health in Montana, and crisscrossed the state giving talks to churches, community groups, and health professional organizations. This doesn't sound like retirement to me. Rob says there's really only one difference in his work hours.
I actually sleep most of the night now, which was rare.
Rob and Laurie also meet regularly with their Republican Congress members, but report no policy wins thus far.
Sometimes we think we see progress, other times it's frustrating. We do get discouraged like everybody else. We have a choice to keep fighting and working on this, or we can curl up in a ball and give up. It just would be wrong not to do everything we can where we have something to add.
Surveys is that an astonishingly large percentage of people would take climate action if invited by someone they know and respect. Here's how Cynthia Mahoney, the kidney doctor we met at the start of the episode, got her invitation.
My good buddy, Peter Joseph, was an ER doc at the hospital where I worked, and we spent a lot of nights together in the ER with critically ill patients. He got into working with climate reality, and he gave a fantastic talk for our whole staff. That really blew me away because it was the first time I saw the connection between fossil fuel disinformation, parallels with the tobacco industry. Not only were they using the same playbook for their lies, they were using the same ad agency that the tobacco companies did. Walked up to Peter afterwards to say, this was a great talk. And he whipped out a card and said, when you're ready, call this number. It was like being in a Detective Moore mystery or something. And it was a card for Citizens Climate Lobby.
Now Cynthia invites other doctors. She's been working with a group of health professionals which started promoting healthy voting in 2020 during COVID and has expanded to work on healthy democracy.
We can't have clean air to breathe and a safe climate to live in if we can't elect leaders who are responsive to us. We need a healthy, strong democracy.
Sometimes that meant going out of her comfort zone. At one point, they were getting signatures for an open letter calling on U.S. senators to support the Voting Rights Act. They needed at least one health professional from every state to sign the letter, but there were states where they didn't have any connections.
So we Googled public health schools, nursing schools, medical schools, major health systems. We called Missouri, we called South Dakota, and we managed to get a signer from all 50 states. My father was a salesman. He sold real estate and insurance, and he was always trying to get me as a high school student to do cold calls. And I found that all terribly embarrassing, and I would just cringe and like, oh, don't make me do that. And yet, all these years later, that's essentially the kind of thing I'm doing, but it's so different when you believe in it and the cause is so important and you think you can make a difference.
Cynthia's Healthy Voting Group has not given up. With voting rights under attack, one important strategy is to register more voters.
That circle of eligible voters who are unregistered overlaps very strongly with our most vulnerable and marginalized patients.
VoteER is a nonpartisan health facility-based voter registration program. It started with a single iPad in a Boston emergency room and has grown to include over 26,000 health professionals and over 500 health centers and hospitals.
The patients at these facilities see a prominent QR code on posters in waiting areas, at check-in, on prescription pads, and in hospital discharge instructions. Scanning the code with a phone links you to a mobile app where you can register to vote or request a mail-in ballot in under 90 seconds.
Inquiries about patients' registration status are built right into the process.
Just like you say, do you smoke? Do you use seatbelts? Are you registered to vote? Because that matters to your health.
Even though we lost ground on voting rights over the last year, Cynthia is not discouraged.
This isn't doom and gloom, and it's making me feel bad because I'm immersing myself in this difficult, scary problem. It's actually the opposite. It's really, I'm going to say, joyful and hopeful. Joyful and hopeful.
I'd always been active in electoral politics, and I would always be so relieved once the election was over. I could go back to my normal life. But one year, I met up with some people who were leafleting about climate change, and I looked at their literature and began to be, ooh, you can't just put this away between elections. Whoa, as we say now, I was woke.
That's Robin Cooper. She's a mostly retired psychiatrist in California. Robin applies her professional skills to help bridge that gap between anxiety and action.
Trying to help people tolerate the feelings so that they don't retreat to a sense of closing their eyes, what we call denial or disavowal, and tolerating the feelings that they have to move them to engagement and action.
Robin says that people doing climate work also need emotional support, especially the young ones.
Our youth activists are rightfully angry, justifiably enraged at the kind of world that they expect to inherit. But they're also, as you should be, infused with an urgency, which we all need, but the successes don't always come. And that can feel very demoralizing. And helping those young activists to not give up, but to hold the long vision, even when long vision doesn't seem to be within the scope of what physics and science is presenting us with. Working with those youth groups on sustaining their emotional resilience is one of the areas that I've had some involvement and would like to expand even more.
Robin also helped found the Climate Psychiatry Alliance with like-minded colleagues, and they're pushing the American Psychiatric Association to get on board.
Turning professional organizations around is like doing a turn for one of those mega boats. It's slow going, but we've been told by the leadership that we are moving at rapid pace. And of course, none of us think it's rapid enough, but we've penetrated the organization significantly.
A decade of work like Rob and Robin's to engage their health professional organizations led to the Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health, which now advocates for healthy climate policy on behalf of member organizations representing over 600,000 U.S. physicians.
Robin, like Cynthia, finds that working on climate is good for her own mental health.
I don't put my eye on whether we succeed or not. The sense of meaning and the sense of community in my life. And also, I haven't had to face what some of my colleagues who retire and can't fill up their lives with things that are meaningful. I don't have that kind of emptiness or grief around moving into a part of my life that doesn't feel engaged. Part of my life that doesn't feel engaged.
I read a book that flipped my climate switch.
Sue Donaldson is another psychiatrist based in Massachusetts.
It's by a guy named Carl Safina, who is a naturalist and an oceanographer. And it's called The View from Lazy Point. It goes through a year of his watching the seasons change and watching all the wildlife. You know, he sees these birds migrating at a certain time and realizes that it's earlier than they usually do, and that when they get where they're going, there won't be the things that they usually eat there, and so they're going to be in trouble. And just this sense of how interconnected the world was and how climate change was totally screwing that up. It was something I hadn't really thought about or tuned into at all, and this book was kind of a holy moly moment. Soon thereafter, I went to a training that was given by 350 Massachusetts. At the end of the training, you were supposed to go up and write on these big pieces of paper one thing that you were committing to do for the climate. And I looked at what I had written, and I had written, in 1 year, I'm going to be retired and doing this full time.
Dr. Donaldson is pretty hardcore. She found herself doing stuff she hadn't dreamed of.
Finding myself in Harvard Square with a bullhorn took a little cranking up. I'm kind of an introvert.
And she still carries a doctor-sized workload.
I can read something for half an hour over lunch as opposed to writing the notes while I eat lunch. But I'm pretty busy.
Sue says psychiatry has given her a deeper understanding of climate denial.
Understanding how people can believe things that seem unbelievable or can deny things that seem to me quite obvious, and how difficult it is to convince people otherwise when they believe something or want to think something or don't want to think about something.
And is it worth trying to convince those folks?
No. If they're really entrenched in denying, it's not. If people are just sort of not that interested or don't know about it, you can engage them, usually not with facts and arguments. I find that just telling people what I'm doing, they get sort of intrigued. Like, I've been arrested a couple of times, and I'll say to somebody, oh, you know, I've been arrested. And they're like, for what? And they say, oh, you know, climate protest, you know, stopping a gas pipeline. And then they sort of get intrigued because they realize, wow, this is something that's really important to me. And they get interested in why I think it's that important.
But really, Sue says the time for talk therapy is over.
Increasingly, it just feels like, why isn't everybody's hair on fire like mine is? And what can we do that is more effective or persuasive or convincing than a rally or a march or hold a sign? There was a gas pipeline that was being put in Boston. It went through a neighborhood very close to an active quarry where they were having explosions, which seemed a little unwise. And it went right down a main street where there were houses and everything right there. So if there are any leaks or explosion, which is not that uncommon, these people who were right in the line of fire, they had repeated civil disobedience of people blocking construction, just sort of showing up and jumping into the trench. Interestingly, a lot of the Boston cops live in that neighborhood. So at least initially, they were very courteous with us and almost supportive, despite the fact that they would arrest us. Later, they got a little fed up with us and were less pleasant about it. Then there was a new compressor station that was built in a terrible location right on the coast where it's going to flood near environmental justice communities. A number of us tried to get in the way of the construction. People talk about who has the privilege of being able to get arrested. And obviously, people who don't have to get to work the next day, people who don't have a license that they worry about losing if they have a conviction. Of course, white people tend to be better treated by police, people who are not undocumented. So we are a crowd that really ought to be right out there.
For Lisa Del Buono, a pathologist in Michigan, there was no oh crap or holy moly moment, just a creeping sense of discomfort listening to the news on the way to work.
I started having this gnawing feeling about climate change. When I first got involved, I actually went to a lawyer and said, well, what do I need to know in case I get arrested? You know, I had no skills in terms of understanding politics at all or how things worked or how to engage with members of Congress. The first time I met with a member of Congress, I had carved the time out at work, and I ran over to the in-district office and when I finished with the meeting, I came back to the office and I kept telling everybody, did you know you could meet with your member of Congress? I had no idea you could meet with your member of Congress.
She decided that's where she belonged.
We need both things, but I should work to what I do well. If there's a hope that we can bring people to the table, that's one of my skills, and I should try to do that as best I can.
Lisa says stories from doctors and nurses can be particularly powerful.
Health is the human face of the climate crisis. You know, we think of the climate crisis in terms of polar bears, but really our physical health is how it's manifested in humans. And it brings it home to the average person in a way that's more impactful, easier to remember than the data would be. So I think it's incredibly important to have data and that evidence to inform our decision-making. But in the end, it's the story that moves people.
Lisa has been organizing health professionals to tell these stories in public testimony to Michigan's Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy, and to the Michigan Public Service Commission to pressure utilities in support of state goals for carbon neutrality by 2050 and 100% clean electricity by 2035.
We're trying to bring the point that climate solutions are health solutions. I work as many hours as I did as a pathologist. I was a workaholic and still am a workaholic. It's a passion, and I'm very grateful to have the flexibility and time to do that.
One thing about taking up what's essentially a new career is the chance to fulfill life goals that your old job didn't provide. For Lisa, that was teaching.
I always wanted to teach. I went to medical school largely because it was my father's unfulfilled dream. I love that I've been able to bring students from high school through medical school in to speak with legislators and encourage them to speak publicly or write letters to the editor. I love doing that. It allows me to tap into my not fully realized passion for education. I feel like this is our opportunity to save what is exquisitely beautiful about humanity and life on Earth. And if I have the ability to be part of the solution, I want to do everything I personally can to contribute.
As another doctor turned climate activist, don't we get to hear your story?
Sadly, we don't have time. But I will say that I found a way to weave something I always wanted to do, storytelling, into my climate work. Exhibit A being this radio show and podcast. You've heard from retired doctors, but they're not the only ones joining the climate movement. There's moms, students, farmers, retired executives, teachers, and engineers. It's like a potluck. Bring something to share and find something you like. You don't have to be the whole meal. Because when we all pitch in, it comes together. I mean, when's the last potluck you've been to where everyone brought a salad?
Whatever your stage of life, line of work, personality, or amount of free time, there's room in this movement for you too.
If you're over the age of 60, Bill McKibben has created a new climate organization just for you. It's called Third Act.
It seemed to me unfair that we were just taking the biggest problems on the planet and assigning them to 17-year-olds as extra homework or extra curricular activity. We need older people because, A, we vote in enormous numbers, 70 million of us, Americans over the age of 60, a population larger than France, the most politically potent part of the population. And we have most of the assets. 70% of the money in America has ended up, fairly or not, in the hands of the baby boomers and the silent generation above them. So if we're going to take on either Washington or Wall Street, it won't be done without the full participation of people of a certain age. There are two things that we focus on at Third Act. One is trying to stabilize our democracy, because we can't do anything else if we don't have that. And two, we're trying to stabilize the climate. The first big campaign we're running is to take on the four big banks, Citi, Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, that between them are far the biggest lenders to the fossil fuel industry. They've handed over $1 trillion to big oil since the Paris Climate Accords were signed. So people are signing this pledge saying, we're tearing up our credit cards and pulling our accounts at year's end if you guys can't get it together, if you just go out this afternoon and cut up your credit card, it's probable, unless you have very out of control spending habits, that Chase or Citi or Wells or B of A won't even notice. So it's much smarter if we try and figure out how we're going to do this as a group and bring some real power to bear on it.
As for protecting democracy,
it seems, at least for the moment, that progress in Washington is almost impossible because of the unwillingness to override the filibuster and pass significant protections. So we're assembling a force of people, thousands upon thousands of volunteers, who month by month will be able to do phone calls, text banking into the parts of the country where the issue is most inflamed, whether it's the places that are trying to replace their election commissioners or gerrymander their districts or whatever it is. We need a kind of rapid response force from around the country that can help train attention and effort on particular places. And happily, you know, technology allows us to do that. Everybody now has a really potent weapon in their hand with that smartphone. And one of the things that experienced Americans, as you might call them, have that other Americans have less of is time. And that time may turn out to be the real secret weapon here.
COVID removed one barrier to organizing elders.
The pandemic taught everybody in the country how to use Zoom. So we're getting thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people at these monthly calls that we're doing at Third Act. People are coming in from all over the country, but of course, given the demographics, most powerfully from Florida, Arizona, all the places where there are a lot of older people. And that's good because some of those are really profound swing states and places where we need to mobilize political power.
Members are being organized into state chapters and also by former occupation.
Third Act clergy or business people or teachers or nurses. And I think those are going to emerge as very powerful forces too, because they come with credibility attached. The thing we keep hearing back from people who join up is, man, this is the thing that I've been waiting for because I wanted to be involved, but I didn't know quite how. I've spent my whole life in business or whatever it is, not in activism, but now I'm ready. I'm retired. I've got time. I care about my grandkids. And it's really a relief to have someone saying, here's how you can have some plausible chance of making an impact.
So if you're over 60 and worried about climate change, Bill's got a job for you. Get on over to thirdact.org and sign up. I'm Brian Curtis.
I'm Wendy Ring. Thanks for joining us for Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up.
Thanks to our guests Rob Byron, Cynthia Mahoney, Robin Cooper, Lisa Del Buono, Sue Donaldson, and Bill McKibben.
And to Scott Holmes, Lobo Loco, One Man Book, and Mr. Smith for our music.